And we will conclude our discussion of bioethical issues in the Renaissance period with the section I've labeled number 3, Theologians and Magisterium on Abortion and Contraception. We return again to beginning of life issues, noting this time that it's not just a discussion of moral theologians among themselves offering various opinions that may be more or less influential, but as we shall see, the direct intervention of the magisterium in the form of official papal statements, which attempt to define some line of clarity in regard to the discussion. And one of the points that raises, I would say, the necessity for a papal intervention is the theological position put forward by Thomas Sanchez in section 3.1. And I should mention that Sanchez is a respected moral theologian in many other areas. He is quoted specifically by Alphonsus Ligurian as regarded as an important precedent, but as we'll see, the opinions that he puts forth here will be specifically repudiated. Sanchez drew on the traditions that we've already seen of Antoninus of Florence and of Antoninus of Cordoba in regard to the significance of the morality of early and late abortion in regard to the question of the embryo's ensoulment. And he proposed, frankly, that before ensoulment, it would be possible to abort the embryo directly, to intentionally abort the embryo in order to save the mother's life, but after ensoulment, there could be no direct abortion, even though one could use medications or other modalities that might indirectly cause a woman's death. And as we can see, this conclusion had been hinted at or is prefigured at the edges of some of the opinions that we've already seen, but he stated it quite openly and bluntly. And there were a number of theologians who were listed in the second paragraph. And by the way, all of this is from chapter 12 of Jones' text on the soul of the embryo. There were a number of theologians who agreed with this, everyone agreeing that indirect or unintended abortion in order to save the life of the mother was perfectly acceptable. This is the question of whether an earlier abortion could conceivably be permissible. And the argument that Sanchez brings to bear, which is in the following paragraph and which I've highlighted in white, is his statement that before ensoulment, the embryo is not a separate being but is part of the body of the mother, and therefore she would have the right to dispose of it. And she could remove it, much as one might be able to remove any other part of the body that was threatening or diseased. And again, one can catch echoes of this in modern discussions as well. Well, over time, as is noted here by Jones at the bottom of this section containing Sanchez's opinion, his position gradually lost support. Well, more specifically, there were two papal statements towards the end of the 16th century. The first by Pope Sixtus V in his decree Ephre Natam, and then, as we'll see, by Gregory XIV in his decree Sedis Apostolicae. And in the first, Pope Sixtus V decided that the way to deal with the ongoing discussion and pushing the limits of acceptability among theologians and indeed to curb the practice of abortion, he felt that the best way of dealing with this, to emphasize the significance of abortion entailing an excommunication, but entailing an excommunication that would be a reserved sin and, as he specifically indicates, a sin reserved to the Holy See, that is, which could only be absolved by the Pope or the Pope's specific delegate. And one of the unique aspects, which Jones notes in the sections that I've labeled here, is number one, that this decree was promulgated not just in a particular region or diocese, but for the whole Church, that it reserves to the Pope alone the right to lift the excommunication that is incurred by abortion, and it did not include only abortion, but also the use of substances that would induce sterility, therefore contraception as well. So it is a very, very strict approach and turned out to be completely unworkable. But it does represent the desire of the papacy to intervene in a way that would make clear the seriousness of the crime of abortion. It was attempted to be lived out for a very limited period of time. His successor, Pope Gregory XIV, issued a constitution, Sedes Apostolicae, that substantially modified this by maintaining that, yes, indeed, the excommunication exists, but it's only for the abortion of a formed fetus. And the question of formation, there again was along rather Thomistic lines, the 40 or 80 or 90 day approach. And also, he removed the aspect of the excommunication that included contraception. This was only specifically for intended abortion after the 40 to 80 day period, and it was no longer reserved to the Holy See. That is, it was not just the Pope or his delegate who could dispense from this excommunication or absolve from it, but it could be done by the local bishop. And one might want to note parenthetically, as is mentioned in the very last line here by Jones, that this was the approach that remained officially in effect until the end of, towards the end of the 19th century, until 1869, when it was narrowed again, and there was no distinction made between an early or a late abortion. The idea of abortion incurring an excommunication which would be reserved to the bishop is still extant in some dioceses, and in fact, of course, in canon law, the performing of or the being complicit in the successful carrying out of an abortion does result in an automatic excommunication, which the bishop can, if the bishop chooses, grant faculties to the clergy to absolve from this excommunication. And that is done in most dioceses of the United States, but not all. There are a number of dioceses in which the excommunication that is incurred for abortion is still a reserved sin that can only be absolved theoretically by the bishop, but in practice by contacting the chancery uniquely each and every time that one encounters that pastoral circumstance of someone who's confessed to an abortion. But again, in many, many dioceses, in fact, in the majority of them, the faculty to grant the absolution is given to every priest along with the faculties to absolve at the time of his ordination. But what we see here is the attempt on the part of the magisterium to directly intervene, to cut short what is regarded as problematic and too far wide-ranging discussion, and an effort to explore the ways in which this could possibly be done. First, by very restrictive legislation that turned out to be unworkable, obviously having everyone have to resort to the Holy See every time an abortion is confessed is unworkable. And then later narrowing the scope, but also recognizing that the fact that contraception was included in the initial text of Ephronatum gives us a sense of how serious this was regarded, even though it was removed from the automatic excommunication in the subsequent papacy of Gregory XIV. Now, the next section for us to be aware of is the official magisterial condemnation of the moral approach of laxism, which is connected with the tradition of probabilism that allowed people and confessors to both grant absolution for, but also to encourage people to not be overly concerned about the sinfulness of certain sins, depending on whether the issue itself was one that was being seriously debated by moral theologians. And in order to deal with what were seen as the problematic consequences of this overly lax approach, a series of propositions were condemned, and among them were numbers 34 and 35 that have to do with abortion. And it gives us an idea, again, of the Holy See intervening in such a way as to say, this discussion has gone too far, let's be clear about this point. For example, number 34, it is condemned, the proposition is condemned, that it is permissible to procure abortion before the ensoulment of the fetus. And context of this, of course, is specifically given that it would result in disgrace or even in the death of the woman who then became known to be pregnant and who had become pregnant, perhaps through an act of fornication. Well, the Holy See is condemning the idea that it is permissible to procure abortion before the fetus is ensouled. So that is condemned as a laxist proposition. And also, the position that the fetus in the womb lacks a rational soul and only acquires one at birth. Now, this was not a particularly widespread theological opinion, but it was an attempt to set limits for further discussion. Majority opinions, if you drop down a couple of paragraphs that I've labeled 1 through 4, are, number 1, what we've already seen many times now, the opinion of Aquinas, which you got from Aristotle, that ensoulment happens at 40 days for males and 80 or 90 days for females. But there were other opinions based on texts derived from the Hippocratic documents that estimated 35 and 42 days, or a statement drawn from St. Augustine that seemed to suggest 46 days, and there was also what would, of course, become the Church's official teaching subsequently, the idea that ensoulment, or the bestowal of that which makes the developing embryo uniquely human, occurs either at the time of conception or within a few days of conception. So that is being mooted, that is being raised, but it is not the majority opinion at this time, again, because of the strong influence of Aquinas and of Aristotle. And it's important to note, as is particularly highlighted here by Jones in his text, that the idea of ensoulment not taking place until birth, which was an idea that began to be raised by a certain of the more, they regarded themselves as being more scientifically oriented individuals in the 16th century and onwards, that idea was unprecedented in the Christian ethical tradition and was shocking even to the most liberal minds of the age. And finally, I've included from Jones' discussion a reference to Dominic Viva, who writes at the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century, that these questions, as we've noted in the past, they don't deal specifically with the question of what happens if the mother's life is in jeopardy. And he tries to say that early abortion could be regarded as a kind of homicide, but imperfect homicide. So he's trying to find moral categories that describe the seriousness of this action, but not equating it with the death of a of the equivalent death fully developed or adult person. But he tries to point out a spectrum that exists, and he points out that there was no theologian at this time who regarded it as acceptable for a man to engage in sexual behavior outside of the context that could result in generation, that is to say, what were regarded as reasons of health. It was sometimes felt to be necessary for the sake of a man's health for him to have sexual intercourse. Well, the Church denied that, and so that's not true if you are using that as a justification for engaging in behavior that is not ordered towards the possibility of generation. Everybody agreed with that at this time, and he points out that, okay, that's the case, so because it is regarded as a notion of the destruction of that generative principle, that direct abortion of an embryo before ensoulment was an even more serious sin and was much closer to real, or as he calls it, perfect or perfected homicide. So here again, we see a spectrum of opinion, Rome having intervened in the case of the extreme opinions that had been expressed, but theologians who are beginning to approximate what will become the approach that one would find acceptable up to our own time, and that is that one may not destroy life for the sake of preserving life in the case, the rather horrific case of a woman at the time of delivery who is not able to deliver her child.